this week when devices got connected to the internet.
The Internet of Things is probably the biggest disruptor and the biggest opportunity that technology has put in front of us for a long, long time.
The moment the connected revolution got its name.
In the mid-90s, senior executives knew they had to do something with the internet. They just didn't know what. So I called my pitch to my management, the Internet of Things.
And a look ahead to how we might be transferring our social identities online.
I do think there's a great opportunity for biometrics. I think the time is starting to finally come.
The history of the internet.
Welcome to the History of the Internet, a series exploring the trends that started online that now dominate the way we carry out our day-to-day lives. I'm Jamie Wareham. This podcast is supported by The Memo. They're all about making the future more human. We've partnered up with them, so go read more about this series on their website, thememo.com. In the series so far, we've explored the history of hashtags to what drives online trends and even visual memes. But this week we go beyond the online world of the social internet and into the sensors, thinking and connected devices that are changing how our lives are run and making them even more like an episode of The Jetsons.
Meet George Jetson! His boy Elroy!
Today's episode is on the Internet of Things.
And so I was working for a consumer goods company called Procter & Gamble in the 1990s. I was in marketing.
Kevin Ashton has been a regular contributor to the show already. In other episodes, we've spoke to him about memes and trends. But today, it's a show entirely inspired by the term that he named.
And one of our most popular products, which was a particular colour of lipstick, was very hard to find in stores, which was very frustrating because we knew it was going to be popular. We'd made lots of them. They were sitting in the warehouse. They weren't selling because there was none to find on the shelf. As I was trying to solve this relatively small problem, I started to understand that it was a symptom of a very big problem, which was that computers really didn't have any way of gathering their own information about the physical world.
With everything we now know today, you can probably see where Kevin's going with this. If only computers could work out what was going on in the physical world and then make decisions that cut out humans. So surely working at an international brand powerhouse like Procter & Gamble, albeit in the 90s, they'd revel at the opportunity to save money and embrace the internet revolution.
Now, I had to explain all this to a bunch of old white senior executives who didn't know much about computers, frankly.
Alas.
In the mid-90s, senior executives knew they had to do something with the internet. They just didn't know what. So I called my pitch to my management, the Internet of Things.
At least this meeting solidified the name.
And that was a term we used a lot. I went to MIT in the US and we started a research lab, and it was a term I used a lot in a fairly small community of computer scientists and engineers. And at some point, it reached critical mass.
So let's get into this week's timeline and find out where that moment of realization and that meeting fits in the Internet of Things wider story. This week, Daniel Burris is helping us through as a researcher and futurist who has been working with technology that we can still only dream of today. Since, well, the 80s, he is well placed to help us out. Today, we go right back to the first connected device that shaped the story of the Internet of Things. And this week, Karen Bevan gives us the important dates.
1844, Samuel Morse sends the first Morse code public telegraph message, "What hath God wrought?" from Washington, D.C. to Baltimore.
Yeah, well, the Internet of Things is really connecting machines, communicating with machines, as well as sensors communicating with machines.
1950, Alan Turing, in his article Computing Machinery and Intelligence in the Oxford Mind Journal, said, "It can also be maintained that it is best to provide the machine with the best sense organs that money can buy, and then to teach it to understand and speak English. The process could follow the normal teaching of a child."
Essentially, what Alan was doing was imagining the opportunities of computers learning. and he was suggesting they could do it by being provided with sensors, just like the modern Internet of Things devices that we're going to talk about later on.
1989, Tim Berners-Lee proposes the World Wide Web.
A key point for the whole internet, TBH.
1990, John Romke created the first internet device, a toaster that could be turned on and off over the internet.
When a invisible opportunity becomes visible, in that moment you get a flash of foresight that allows you to move forward in a way that you couldn't have before.
And so the connected device revolution began.
1993, an experiment at the University of Cambridge called the Trojan Room Coffee Pot was used to monitor coffee pot levels with an image being updated about 3 times a minute and sent to the building server. It was later put online for viewing once browsers could display images.
It's basically an early webcam, and obviously a riveting one at that. But the real lesson that we can take from this part of the timeline is it was a sensor being used to monitor something in the physical world.
1999. The Internet of Things term is coined by Kevin Ashton.
And I think the Internet of Things, using that phrase, was it gave it that sexiness and it gave it that, wow, that's kind of a cool phrase.
In the year 2000, starting off what is now a meme, LG announces its first internet refrigerator plans.
I noticed a bit of a tendency among tech companies to continually harp back to the same idea again and again, which was, well, we've got fridges. What if fridges had the internet on them?
And we'll hear more from Roo, the king of Tumblr piss takes, later on.
2005. The Internet of Things hit another level when the UN's International Telecommunications Union published its first report on the topic.
You know, the foundation of my work over the last 30-something years has been separating the hard trends, the future facts, from the soft trends, the ifs or maybes. And it is always a milestone when a organization or a government agency, or a nation or a world starts to realize this is not science fiction, this actually is a future fact.
And in 2008, US National Intelligence Council listed the Internet of Things as one of the 6 disruptive civil technologies with potential to impact on US interests.
And at the same time, companies like IBM, Cisco, and Ericsson really ploughed investment into the Internet of Things technology. And very quickly, the entire world, business and government, were awake to the potential of the Internet of Things.
The change curve is an exponential curve, and right now, if you pictured that curve like a hockey stick, we're about where you would put your hands on that hockey stick. It's almost going vertical. The biggest benefit of the Internet of Things that I'm the most excited about is the ability to predict and prevent. And technology will help us to do that.
So the whole world is awake to the Internet of Things. What kind of products does this mean that we get?
The first product, it's based on Bot Vision, which is a SLAM technology, meaning simultaneous localization and mapping.
Avril Murphy from robot Hoover company Neato.
Very, very clever, going around the room using lasers that rebound to get off against objects. And it's the light reflection that analyzes the positioning of the robot, which the main advantages are it knows exactly where it is and where it's going. So very, very intelligent device.
Okay, cool. A robot hoover with SLAM technology. One that maps your room, learning the best way to hoover it. And it can be controlled from a smartphone app. But is that actually useful?
Well, I mean, I've come across very few people who enjoy vacuuming.
That's totally fair. But it does raise the question, along with the Wi-Fi kettle, are Internet of Things products just all gimmicks? Neato would, of course, say no. And their sales, they would say, are through the roof. But what about an internet-enabled fridge?
I think when you're doing a funny thing on the internet, it's very hard for it to be broad. It has to, well, I find the easiest way of having fun is to be very, very specific.
This is Roo Reynolds.
Hello, I'm Roo Reynolds, and I don't know how to describe myself. I think I do things on the internet, probably.
Which massively undervalues him as a serial tumbler of very important things. You might remember him from such blogs as
photos of Colonel Gaddafi shaking hands with world leaders, because that was the thing that needed collecting.
And
photos of things riding on the back of other things. That one's a bit more active. Thingsridingonthings.tumblr.
But today we're talking because of his internet fridge tumbler.
The fridge tumbler came about, I think it was as early as February 2011. I had to check that in preparation for this. I noticed a bit of a tendency among tech companies when they were wanting to announce interesting innovations that they'd come up with to continually harp back to the same idea again and again, which was, well, we've got fridges. What if fridges had the internet on them?
Genius. And how does this all make him feel?
I do feel a sense of resigned disappointment in the future. I sense that we could be doing more with ourselves and our technology.
Tell us what you really think, you know?
I'm on board, right? Don't get me wrong. I think the future is great and we're going to have exciting things. And we're going to have, hopefully, much more seamless, frictionless interaction with shops because they're very boring, frankly. So, yeah, no, I'm looking forward to my house noticing that I'm running low on pot noodles or beans or whatever. The fridge isn't cutting it, but the problems are not to do with internet connectivity or displays, because those are just commodity items that you plug into any bit of technology. It's the sensing. Like, how do you know that you're running low on beans? Because until we have RFID chips on every tin of beans rather than every pallet of beans, and there's a lot of reasons that that's difficult, it's going to be really tough.
RFID tags? Okay, so they're teeny tiny radio frequency identification tags. They have electromagnetic fields to automatically identify and track tags attached to objects. They're literally the size of a grain of rice. And they're part of the solution that Kevin was talking about right at the beginning of the show with his pallets of lipstick.
You know, RFID tags are often cited by these companies as being, oh, we're nearly there, we're going to get there. But, you know, the unit cost of an RFID tag is still almost as great as the margin that you're making on selling a tin of beans. So it's going to be a long time before introducing it.
And look, they are really useful in warehouses and industrial cataloguing. But in order for them to help me and you order beans or pot noodles when we run out, we're going to have to all be a lot more open about that data, which is part of many people's apprehension in adopting Internet of Things products. Are they even secure?
So we have Nest Learning Thermostat, Nest Protect, Nest Cam Indoor, Nest Cam Outdoor.
That's Lionel Gauchard-Callan from the product marketing team at Nest. They sell a multitude of devices that make your house a smart and connected home.
You know, I have a lot of respect for the Jetsons, but sometimes I feel sad for them because it's a vision. We are not trying to design the home of the geeks where you're going to tell the things what to do, how to do, when to do it. I think the key there is having that kind of magical experience when technology gets out of the way.
So from thermostats to cameras, they say it's all about networking that technology you already have so you can use it better.
When is the last time you pay attention to your thermostat, right? But this thing is controlling 60% of your energy bill. And quite frankly, if you can save 10, 50, 20% on it, because technology will do the job for you, then that's money you can spend on something else that could be more pleasant.
With hacking becoming a regular phenomenon and hitting global headlines, with data driving our world, is all of this safe? Could we see a situation like in that episode of Mr. Robot, where we're literally hacked out of our smart homes?
You have different level of security. I think we are doing everything from an encryption point of view of, let's take the example of the camera, is we are encrypting the data on the camera, and we are using a technology there, which is an RCA key. And to break it, essentially, you will need the fastest computer in the world, and you will be the age of the earth multiplied by 4,000 times, so that's more than 11 billion years to essentially crack that key to get the information. But then it's the content that we encrypt, it's also the transmission to the cloud, and every session that we create is unique. So things like man in the middle or people that are trying to guess through repetitive URLs won't happen, and we obviously encrypt everything.
Okay, so safeguards do exist. Looking elsewhere in the world, Visa are protecting payments with tokenization. We're actually going to speak to them in a bit. WhatsApp even have their end-to-end encryption. But frankly, as with any service we sign up for, it's all about the exchange of our personal privacy that's valuable to the company. And we give that up for for an easier experience. So catching up with the latest advances since I've done these interviews, voice activation devices have hit the mainstream, and they're further fueling and piquing our interest in Internet of Things devices. Thanks to Amazon, and I won't name her because that is always very confusing for your Echo device, just in case you're listening to this podcast on TuneIn. You can now find me talking to lamps, asking for music, and even asking for cat facts at home. Ask Cat Fact to tell me a cat fact.
Here's your fact. Cats have more than 100 different vocal sounds.
But let's take the Internet of Things out of the house and beyond even wearables, just briefly, because I sat down in the height of summer in a heavenly air-conditioned room with futurist Tom Cheeseman and Sandra Rosetta from Visa to discuss connected cities, security, and how we might be closer to some of those dystopian films than you might imagine.
So I love the idea of the connected city bringing joy. It's a great way of thinking of things. And maybe some good examples there. One is Barcelona. I love what they've done. They've looked at how people travel. They've gathered a load of data. And they've actually developed a new bus route based on what people actually want to do. And they've even figured out a way of making sure that for those bus routes, you know, the traffic lights turn to green as often as possible.
The word invisible is really important. If you look at the last 50 years of technology, you know, a device in that sense has gone from a room-sized thing that was this giant ogre of a machine that you had to be very polite in communicating with, down to something you slip in your pocket and toss on the table and shout at to get it to do stuff. The next natural step in that progression is for that technology to disappear completely, to vanish into the walls, into the furniture, into the cars, into everything else.
With smart concrete and bridges telling engineers when cracks and faults are appearing, to those smart traffic systems that Sandra was talking about. That is all invisible tech, and it's quietly liberating our lives. So, with sensors all around, are we getting close to the film Minority Report? For those of you who don't know the storyline, it's a world where everyone's eyes get scanned everywhere they go, even when, say, you're walking past the Gap.
Hello, Mr. Yakamoto. Welcome back to the Gap. How those assorted tank tops work out for you?
Mr. Yakamoto. So actually there's a company already doing those adverts, a company called Offer Moments, who I've been tracking. So you know, those Minority Report style adverts are already out there. It's not scanning your irises yet, but it is reacting to your mobile phone and starting to understand you. You know, those cards you wave at the doors as you walk around your office, we don't really need that in the long term. You just need to stick a camera above a door and it can look at you and identify you through all sorts of means, whether it's scanning your eyes or maybe an infrared camera that recognises your heartbeat signature. You know, there's many different ways to identify a person without sticking bits of silicon inside them.
Well, actually, there was a club that did that a number of years ago. You know, the kids that were going there were able to have a chip embedded into their arm, and many did. But then when they had to get it dug out, it wasn't such a great story.
By the way, Sandra's going to say biometrics a lot now. So if you don't know what they are, they're human characteristics. Just like, for example, your fingerprint.
The question really is about biometrics and how do we see biometrics kicking off. I do think there's a great opportunity for biometrics. I think the time is starting to finally come, in that you need a couple of things to come together. The technology needs to work, and I think the technology is finally there or getting there. And consumers need to accept and feel comfortable.
With all this talk of chips and tech scanning you, it's easy to see this as a sensor revolution. But really, it's a data revolution. And this is where our social behaviours, both online and offline, really count. All of this data that we've spoken about in this series so far is being collected on the way that we act, and business is paying attention.
I think from an AI perspective, what AI does is it allows huge amounts of data to be crunched, which with the Internet of Things is vital. You know, depending on who you talk to, people say that by 2020, there'll be between 20 and 50 billion devices connected. It kind of doesn't matter what the number is. It's going to be an awfully large number. So if that is the case, and I think everyone, you know, believes that it is, we need to find a way of being able to crunch that data and to add value to it.
And that's where AI, artificial intelligence, is going to play a big role. Humans could never crunch that much data, but computers can. So let's bring it back down to a user scale. Just listen to futurist Tom, imagining an AI future in our chat with Visa.
For me, an artificial intelligence or one of the most potentially, come back to this word joy, you know, joyful applications, is to be in two places at once. Things like form filling, you know, tax returns, things like car tax. You know, if all of those, if we can create tiny shards of our personality, micro clones of ourselves and delegate some level of authority to them and let them take care of those things on our behalf, that's a hugely exciting prospect for me.
Imagine an AI clone of you. Imagine one of Taylor Swift. Ooh, imagine one of Donald Trump.
We will make America safe again. And yes, together
we will make America great again. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless America.
Stay subscribed for season 2, where we'll be looking at the history of the technology that is changing the way humans interact with the internet. Our conversations with Visa literally inspired the second season. Stay right where you are for a clip where they revealed the kind of biometric technology they're already working on. There's also probably going to be a slight format change. This series has spoke to so many amazing voices, so it's taken a long time to put together. So before we find out what biometrics you might be paying with, at least if Visa have anything to say about it, credits time. With thanks to Karen Bevan for voicing today's timeline. Creative Commons music today came from Purple Planet Music, our theme Hard Trance and the timeline music Mousetrap, plus The Machine Thinks by Kevin McLeod, Welcome by Cyber SDF, and Good Arcs Sawmill. Season 1 of The History of the Internet has been supported by TheMemo.com. Go over there right now to read loads more about the Internet of Things. There's a reason their tagline is making the future more human. They're absolutely fascinated by how tech and internet devices are changing our world. I love their editorial, covering from the smart concretes of the world to the more cheeky VR porn that could well be developed into sex ed classes in the future. Classy. Also, a big up to Audioboom. This first season was made in my downtime while I was there. I've since left the company. Sad face. Everyone loves a passion project, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast as much as I've had all the hashtag internet bants making it. Keep subscribed, and if you've enjoyed season 1, then why not make season 2 come back even faster by helping us beat those Apple Podcasts, aka iTunes algorithms, by rating, subscribing, and reviewing. Until we're back, send us your memes to internet_pod on Twitter and Instagram. Remember to like our Facebook page or even just email the show if you're missing us. We love seeing your comments, topic suggestions, and of course all that general internet bants that we just love to consume. Check out our old school Hotmail account, internet_pod@hotmail.com. And before I sign off for season 1, here's that clip that I've kept promising from Visa before we go.
So think of that, I think you're there today. Part of today, I this a little bit more intrusive, but possibly, and you know, this vein of recognition. There's all sorts that you know we're working on just now, prototyping and so on. So I do definitely see that being part of the future.
Okay, that's very interesting. What sort of prototypes are you working on at the moment?
We're working on vein recognition. Oh, blimey! Actually, this isn't my area.
Literally, paying in blood. See you in season 2 for more hashtag internet bants.